For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show usually recorded at the RNIB Talking Book Studios. I'm your host, Red Sale, at the kitchen table.
I'm Robert Kirkwood, in my bedroom. And coming up on today's show,
we've got a fantastic new thriller from author Holly Watt.
Narrator Peter Kenny will talk to me about accents and recording at a social distance.
And author Sue Moorcroft will whisk us off to Malta for summer on a sunny island.
All that's coming up in today's Read On.
The deadline is the terrific new thriller from Holly Watt. As with her best-selling debut, To the Lions, she draws on her experience as an investigative journalist to craft a gripping plot that has echoes of Frederick Forsyth and Gerald Seymour. Holly joined me via Zoom to tell me more. Holly Watt, welcome to Read On.
Thank you very much for having me.
For those who haven't yet read The Deadline, could you give us an outline of the plot?
Well, it's a follow-up to my first book, which came out last year. That was To the Lions, and it follows two investigative journalists who basically, they work in London, but their investigations take them all over the world. And The Deadline looks at an international surrogacy ring, partly based in Bangladesh.
And you yourself were an investigative journalist, so presumably you're drawing on some of the experiences you had.
I spent almost 15 years working at the Sunday Times and the Telegraph and the Guardian. I worked on the investigations team at both the Telegraph and the Guardian, so politically all over the place, apart from anything else. And then started writing books. And so there are autobiographical elements in it, and it's certainly sort of part of my journalistic experience is in the book. But at the same time, it's definitely not autobiographical.
That said, you don't shy away from the questions of conscience. Well, one of your characters calls it throwing grenades into people's lives and seeing what happens.
It's always a bit alarming when you get bits of it read out back to you. No, I think the life of an investigative journalist, part of what you do is very destructive. And I think I did sort of 15 years of it and I did absolutely love it. But it was challenging. I think one of the things I realised quite early on is that as a journalist, almost like your best day is somebody else's worst day. And I found that really troubling after a while. I mean, I thought what we did was important and valid. But at the same time, you always have this sort of underlying sense of like somebody else's life being ruined, even if they had been doing something pretty appalling. A lot of the time, they've been doing something absolutely awful. But nevertheless, when you called them up to say, we actually know what you've done, you always had this sense of somebody having just their life pulled apart. And it was dreadful.
Well, yes, you are there to ask the questions that others would prefer to turn a blind eye to. And it does lend itself brilliantly to mystery fiction.
Oh, thank you. No, I think it was one very early on in the whole process. I was speaking to my agent, and he wasn't my agent at the time. I just sent him in this book and been like, I've written this, what do you think? And from the absolute first meeting, he was like, do you think this could be a series? Do you think this is something that could work? And it was just, I didn't do it on purpose, certainly when I was writing the first book, but it was always sort of in the back of my mind that actually journalists are constantly investigating, constantly looking at things. So there is a sort of situation there where a journalist could have a series of stories that they can do. So that was part of the structure from the outset. But I think it's sort of interesting. There are a lot of journalists who've turned to fiction and everything else like that. But I just thought it was kind of an interesting way of doing it. You know, we've got police procedurals, large numbers of them, and they're brilliant. I love loads of them. But I just thought it'd be interesting to do it from a journalist's point of view as well.
Also, is it quite liberating being able to fictionalise some of the facts that you're drawing upon?
Yeah, I mean, I think as a journalist, the boring bits, you know, sitting outside somebody's house for 3 days and being told to sod off. When you're writing fiction, you don't have that. You kind of cut out all the tedium and the boring bits and the stories that you spend months investigating and come to absolutely nothing. So all that is left out of fiction. It's not quite wish fulfillment, but it's along those lines.
Journalism took you to some fairly hot places. You've been on battlefields and amongst some fairly unsavoury characters over the years. So again, presumably fiction can keep you safe from that whilst allowing you to explore the riskier sides from the comfort of your desk.
All these places I travelled to, I at the point in time had no thought of writing books about them. I went all over the world. I went to Afghanistan, to Lebanon, to refugee camps, to Libya, to all these places. And the Lebanon and Libya and Jordan in particular are three places that are in the first book, and then the deadlines based around the refugee camps in Bangladesh. It was odd realizing in hindsight when you write these books just how much these places had affected you. A friend of mine who at the time was working with charities in Jordan, for example, and helped coordinate my visit out to Zaatari refugee camp, she was like, I just didn't realize how much it was affecting you. And I was like, well, I didn't either at the time. I thought I was just out there as a professional sort of doing my job. And I was definitely doing that. But at the same time, you're seeing things which are just completely shocking, particularly in the refugee camps, a sense of people being completely abandoned and forgotten about. People tend to think of refugee camps as kind of like, once you're there, that's the problem solved. You know, it's not ideal, but that's where you are. But I think, I suppose, one of the things we're all discovering in lockdown, that just the fact that you're sitting at home safely, or not even that, in a refugee camp, obviously, but the sort of disasters don't have to be vivid and grim and bombs going off, but they do feel absolutely catastrophic to that person's life anyway. And in a refugee camp, that sense of lives on pause for years and years and years, sometimes entire lifetimes, I think obviously just really stuck with me. That sense of like endless waiting for something better, that quite often in those camps just never shows up.
And as you say, the deadline takes us into the Bangladeshi refugee camps and into factories where fast fashion is being produced. Was fast fashion something that you had to look into as an investigative journalist?
Yeah, in fact, I didn't really look at fast fashion so much in Bangladesh as in a different country, in fact. But it was something I've been very aware of right the way through my working as a journalist. It comes up fairly frequently. And I also did quite a lot of research into Bangladeshi factories. Some of them are pretty horrific.
And the deadline begins with a simple but chilling note sewn into an item of luxury fashion that's found in London and handed to Casey, our heroine. It's actually something that is based in fact.
No, absolutely. There's been quite a few cases. In fact, quite recently, this Christmas just gone, there were Christmas cards, I think, being sold from Tesco that were saying, you know, this has been produced in a factory in China that had terrible human rights conditions. But separately, there have been notes stitched into clothes, sort of known as a way of getting information from factories that are operating under terrible conditions and getting that back to the UK or any other country. I just thought it was quite an interesting route that you could get this information from. Obviously, there'd be a degree of luck in finding it and having the right person find it. Presumably, there's occasional notes that come across that nobody ever notices, and that's that.
This triggers a very fast-paced plot. I've been staying up until 2 o'clock in the morning listening to the book. It's very unputdownable. Did it write quickly?
So for my first book, I wrote it really, really fast. Maybe like 6 weeks, 2 months to get the first draft done. And then went off to the person who is now my agent and said, oh, what do you think of this? And he was like, well, this is a good first draft. And I was a bit like, oh, that's disappointing. I thought that was my novel done. So I think I tend to write the first draft quite quickly. Then the sort of almost like layers of drafts go on over that afterwards. So for the deadline, I wrote the first sort of 60,000 words really fast because I had a month off work. I used to work at The Guardian and I took a month off work to write it. And then I sort of realised that I was going to have to quit my job because my partner lives in Devon and I was working full-time in London. And I also, ironically, had quite a tight deadline for the deadline. So I then decided I'd have to pack in working and live in Devon. And so I sort of wrote the first half really fast, and then there was a pause, and then I wrote the next bit when I quit my job.
It sounds like literary agents might be harder taskmasters than news editors.
No, so I'm being rude about news editors, which I don't mean to be. No, actually, with the world of publishing, I've been astonished by how friendly and kind and nice they all are. And actually, particular crime writers, I mean, they're the ones I know because that's the sector I work in. But they've just been so kind and generous. And there's people like very established writers who are just incredibly kind and thoughtful and supportive. So no, I've been blown away by how nice the publishing world is, which means there's less potential for writing thrillers based in the publishing world, although who knows?
You have a terrific cast of characters. I was particularly taken by Cressida, the fashion editor. She came across as just as committed in her own way as Casey and the rest of the investigative team. Did you find it easy to separate yourself from people that you've met over the years, or did they inevitably creep in?
They definitely inevitably crept in. I mean, for example, when I started in journalism, I started in quite a chaotic way because after university, I did a year at law school. And then failed catastrophically and got chucked out. And so a friend of mine was doing work experience on the Sunday Times style section. And she was like, look, they'll never notice there's two of us rather than one, so why don't you come in as well? So I basically sort of broke into the Sunday Times on a daily basis for quite a long time, sort of theoretically working for the style section. Luckily, we're on the radio here, so you can't see what I'm wearing at the moment, but I was not a natural candidate for the style section of the Sunday Times, who were all very glamorous and beautiful and well put together. So I sort of started on the style section of the Sunday Times and didn't last very long there before migrating out the news desk. But they were a really impressive team. You know, I didn't understand what they were doing at all because, you know, they'd go this pink top or that pink top, and I just see two pink tops and not be able to tell the difference at all. But they really got it and they were brilliant at what they did. So yes, certainly characters who I've, people who I've worked with, bits and pieces of them emerge, but hopefully nobody's offended by it.
And the narrator of the audiobook, Jasmine Blackborough, captures an enormous array of voices. Have you listened to the audiobook yourself?
Yes, I have. It's brilliant. An absolutely fantastic job. It's completely amazing hearing it all and listening. And it is interesting because they sometimes get like different interpretations of things that you hadn't quite thought about. It doesn't matter at all. But for some reason, both me and my editor, lovely Alison Hennessy at Bloomsbury, were absolutely convinced the news editor was Scottish. But in the deadline, because there's a US version and a UK version, for some reason, they completely re-record them for the US, although it's a very similar voice. But anyway, so in one version, the news editor is Cockney. And it was only reading the second book that the lovely narrator realised that actually that he was Scottish. I don't quite know why we didn't realise that before. Anyway, so now throughout, he's got a Cockney accent rather than a Scottish accent. It's one of those things that you're like, oh, that's slightly different. But there we go. It's quite funny because sometimes stuff that... In the second one, it is. Yes, in the second one, there's a character called Lalagi. And I know a girl called Lalagi who's really lovely and great. But anyway, Lalagi, obviously, is quite an unusual name. And for the poor audiobook department at Bloomsbury, they were like, what is this name? How do you pronounce it? Like, what? So it's just things that come out in the audiobook you wouldn't necessarily expect. Frantic calls back to the board trying to work out how to pronounce somebody's name. When, in particular, the US team, when they were recording it, they rang me up and they're like, how do you pronounce this word? And it would be the company name of something that I just completely made up. And I was like, it really doesn't matter how you pronounce that word. It's completely imaginary. I'm not fussed about how you pronounce it.
They sat in the small office for hours. Right, Miranda began. Let's work out how we would do it. One of the old reporters at the Sunday Times had explained that trick to Miranda after the fourth bottle. Put yourself in their head, work out what you would do, and then flip it. And he, half crook himself, had tracked down rogue after rogue.
Jasmine Blackborough narrating The Deadline by my guest, Holly Watt. Now, we've seen Casey and her investigative team in two novels so far. Are you working on a third?
I am. I'm writing 3 and 4, so I can't even imagine what 4 is going to be like at the moment because I'm about 3/4 of the way through the third one, and I'm really enjoying writing it. I really enjoy going back to the same characters and trying to work out what's happening to them next and, you know, who they are. I mean, it's slightly weird because sometimes you're like, oh, gosh, what colour were this person's eyes? And then you have to trawl back through 2 novels to see if you've ever said what colour their eyes are or whatever it is. But I really enjoy it. I really like all the characters. I can see them going forward in different ways and exploring different places. The third one is partly based in Zimbabwe, which I travelled out to last year. It was just, yeah, a fascinating place. Extraordinary.
And hopefully Jasmine Blackborough will be narrating the rest of the series as well.
Oh, well, fingers crossed. I mean, she's done a brilliant job so far.
Normally around publication, there's quite a furore and launch parties and readings. Obviously, you can't do that during the current lockdown. Are you finding other ways of spreading the word about the book?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely kind of not how you'd expect a book launch to go. and the thing is, it's such an unimportant thing in the grand scheme of things that you feel sort of weird even sort of wasting time thinking about it. But at the same time, you know, it's 18 months of work that's gone into it, and you know, it's something that I'd like people to be reading. So we're doing stuff online, we're doing virtual appearances. Obviously, you can do radio and Zoom or anything else like that. We're doing all sorts of things, really. I mean, it's definitely quite weird being in lockdown. You suddenly realise that the life of a writer does involve quite a lot of sitting on your own in a room, funnelling away. And that actually the book launches are kind of like the change of pace, you know, that you kind of go around the country and chat to people and meet people who are interested in your books and all that. So it's definitely a fun part of it all. Suddenly having that taken away is a bit like, oh, all right. But yeah, it's a tiny thing in the grand scheme of things.
And I suppose it has meant that you can crack on with the next book in the series.
No, exactly. And actually, I'm incredibly lucky in that we live in the middle of nowhere in Dartmoor and it's beautiful. And we're not sort of, you know, I think it must be so incredibly difficult for people stuck in cities or in flats and everything else like that. You know, we're in the middle of absolutely nowhere. So isolation isn't that much of a change. I mean, I'm certainly missing kind of seeing friends and going on walks with people. But no, at the same time, it does mean that there's no excuse for sitting down and hammering out book three. So that's what I'm getting on and doing. I'm just very lucky to be here.
Well, Holly Watt, thank you so much for taking a break from the writing and being a guest on Read On. And I'll look forward to welcoming you back and hearing more of the series.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for having me. Real pleasure.
The Deadline by Holly Watt is out now in print, ebook and audio, narrated by Jasmine Blackborough. And Holly will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life.
Here on Read On, the audiobook show, it's not only the authors we're interested in. The narrators are the lifeblood of the audiobook industry. I've recently been listening to Sean Bithell's Confessions of a Bookseller, read by a man who I first worked with a long, long time ago.
He handled the books with the reverence of a minister opening the pulpit Bible. I had polished the leather that morning till it gleamed like silk, and Mr. Pumpherston's fingertips rested upon it as if they were butterflies alighting on a choice flower. He seemed to purr with pleasure at the contact. The visitor adjusted his spectacles before he turned over the pages, and one could see that Mr. Pumpherston's delight was infectious. Augustus Muir, The Intimate Thoughts of John Baxter, Bookseller, Methuen & Co., London, 1942.
The voice of Peter Kenny, reading from Confessions of a Bookseller. And it's a voice I'm sure will be familiar to many Talking Books listeners. And Peter joins me now. Now, Peter, I don't think we should tell the listeners how long ago it was we first worked together.
The numbers are always vulgar.
But it was back in the days of listening books. Yeah, 20 odd years ago, but we won't mention that.
Yes, exactly. Now, yeah. You were mere children. Mere children.
Now, you've worked on every type of audiobook, and let's talk about the most recent one you've done, Roderick Random by Smollett. Now, that was published
1736, I think, 1738, something like that.
The language in that has got to be different to what you're used to.
Ripe and rich, and if you're not careful, you can make a sentence the opposite of how it actually is, what it actually is meant to mean, because it's beautiful language, actually. It's really luscious and lovely and downright hilarious in places as well. I mean, there was one point this morning where his uncle, who's a salty old sea dog, addresses his new bride-to-be in terms of her being a, you know, what's he say? Oh, she's well rigged and she's worth a boarding and all this sort of stuff. I was howling. I just had to stop the recording because I was just laughing too much. It was too ridiculous. But good fun. Great fun.
That's one thing about your accent. I'm taking Roderick Random has Scottish characters, but you can travel the UK with your voice.
Pretty much. I mean, I was born in Scotland. I was born just outside Dumfries, but my parents moved to Merseyside when I was about four years old. So I kind of grew up on the Wirral near Liverpool and then went to university in Hull, lived in London. So I'm kind of, you know, my parents were Irish to add to the mix. So there you go. Worked that lot. Celpictish.
And your time in the Wirral stood you in good stead for reading Paul O'Grady's books?
Well, that's right. I mean, actually, I grew up about probably 2-3 miles from where he lived and where his mum knew my mum. They were both members of a Catholic women's group called the Union of Catholic Mothers, a force to be reckoned with. My dad called them the heavy mob.
Talking of accents, I remember an E.M. Banks book, I think it was Look to Windward.
Yes, and right, yeah.
I'm assuming that was not the only time you've recorded this book, but there was 3 pages of unattributed alien dialogue.
That's right, yeah. It's a party scene, and you've got about, I reckon I worked it out to be 8 characters having overlapping conversations, and the character whose point of view we're at, he's just standing in the middle of them, listening to all these different conversations, and none of them are attributed. And you have to sort of try and work out who is speaking to whom and what conversation is taking place where, and make sure that the right people respond to the right people with the right information, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, and people say it's just sitting in a room reading a book.
Yes, indeed. Well, I mean, I've just been taken on, I've just been taken on to do a couple of books which will require a lot of research into pronunciations of place names, of the names of people, because it's there are books about public figures who are not from these shores. And so I will probably spend maybe almost as long researching the book as I will actually recording it.
Is that what you usually do when you get a book? Take us through the process of prepping for a record.
Well, the first thing, I mean, if I've got the leisure of time, which of course I think we all have a wee bit of at the moment, I would like to just read the book for my own pleasure, you know, because just it's quite often we forget that actually an audiobook is just one person's impression of a book. You know, it's me putting down what the book said and did for me, and that's the best I can do. I can't see the visions that other people see in their mind's eye. I can only see the ones that I see that the author's words inspire. So just to actually read the book and enjoy the pleasure of being a reader is one thing. Having done that, my next step is to start analysing the text for twists in the plot, characters, character names. If it's a book that's set in the real world, then pronunciations of place names or of real people who may be mentioned, you have to make sure you're pronouncing the name right. So there's a lot of preparation goes into that. And that will be, if it's a fiction or a fantasy or something, then I cast the characters. I mean, I kind of think, well, who would play this if they made the movie? And I'll have a little thumbnail image in my head of, I mean, there's a whole range of characters who I call Picard. And they've got nothing to do with Patrick Stewart other than the fact that they dwell in the realm of the character that he portrayed when he played Jean-Luc Picard in the Star Trek movies. I've got some who I call Judi Dench or some that I call Samantha Bond. And it's not me doing an impersonation of those people, but that's who, in my mind's eye, I would cast in that role. And then I'm guided by the author's descriptions of their age, their gender, their species, if it's fantasy or, you know, alien spaceship or whatever. And you mine the script for clues as to their personality. Are they brash? Are they phlegmatic? Are they droll? Are they, you know, whatever? You just mine the script for all the information to create the character.
And how was it when you narrated the Jonasson books? Was there a certain Scandinavian lilt?
No. One of the things that a lot of readers do, and it's I'm not alone in this, is that if you have a book that's in translation from another country, the country that the book is based in, unless they've chosen to actually use a Scandinavian reader who's going to have a proper Scandinavian accent throughout the book. But often they will choose someone like me who's a British native. And so when you have a book that's in translation, the country of origin becomes an analogue of Britain. So, for instance, Stockholm would be and characters from Stockholm would have a London accent. Characters from the north of Sweden would have a northern British accent. And that's how I make sense of it. I mean, I did a whole series of books for Robert Fabry. There's a new series just out, in fact, based in ancient Rome. And so, of course, Rome, Italia, I can't do the friendly Italian book speaking like these, because it would be completely unlistenable at all. You know, it would just be terrible. So you basically, Italia becomes an analogue of Britain. And so Romans who are commoners have Cockney accents, they're told like that, all right, governor. And then you've got your aristocrats who will, you know, aristocrats the same all over the world. And then actually when we went to ancient Britain, having sort of done a bit of research and I decided that I would give the ancient Britons generic Welsh accents, because that's probably closest to what was the common accent in the southern parts of the British Isles during the Roman period. And some people don't understand it. Why is he speaking with a northern British accent when he's from Sweden? Well, it's because I have to get the central character has to have a reality that I can share. Otherwise, it just becomes very weird.
Now, the book I've most recently listened to narrated by you was Confessions of a Bookseller. I'm assuming that performance was a bit, was as droll as the writing.
I attempted to be. I have to say, it's not been that well received. but also, to be fair, I was a bit surprised that that book came my way, because it was the second in a series. And the chap who'd done the previous book did a brilliant job, so I was quite surprised that it landed in my lap. So, but anyway, I love doing it, because I'm in Wigtown. That whole area is a gorgeous part of Scotland, and I've spent time there a lot with family and everything. And though I've actually never been into the bookshop, I have actually walked past it and peered through the windows. And this is long before I knew that I would have any connection directly with Sean, who, of course, is an extraordinary larger-than-life character. I've been following his live broadcasts on Twitter, which he's doing at the moment, which are fantastic, very, very entertaining.
Just search for the Wigtown Bookshop on Facebook. During lockdown, he's doing a video every day. And what about yourself? How are you handling lockdown?
Well, to be honest, it's not been too bad. I mean, we've talked about the Roderick Random that I was recording. That was actually out in a studio, which is in North London. I live in Southwest London. And because we'd started the recording, they said, you know, I did actually get ill, and I was ill for, so I took 3 weeks out to make sure I covered the quarantine, got over the illness after the first 10 days, but, you know, saw out the rest of the quarantine period. And then they said, look, if you don't mind getting to the studio, the producer and you will be in totally separate rooms. You don't need to be any, you don't need, you know, we can keep the 2 meter rule, which we have religiously done. And I wore gloves, so anything I touched, like door handles or anything, would be, and they had antiseptic spray everywhere. And we just finished the recording. So that wasn't too bad. That's been fine. But yeah, it's just living at home. I do have a recording set up at home. I have previously recorded books on it, some quite sort of serious technical tomes about, Russian philosopher Kropotkin, Pyotr Kropotkin, for Ukemi Productions. And I don't mind working at home. I much prefer working with a producer, someone who's going to sit there and go, you slipped that word, or you slurred there, or you didn't, you know, you weren't quite so hot on that as you might be. And because doing that, I mean, I know lots of people are doing fantastic work at home recording on their own, and I'm not denigrating them in any way. I just know that myself, I benefit by having another pair of ears listening to me and saying, no, you can do that better. Or, you know, actually, I'm not sure you're pronouncing that correctly. And because, you know, you'd think by now we would know how to pronounce every single word in the lexicon. But actually, you'd be amazed the amount of words that suddenly pop up. And you think, I have no idea how that is said.
It's coming across that you're very much a perfectionist.
I don't know about that. I think there'd be lots of people who'd beg to differ. I like to get it right. I do like to get it right, because the authors, I mean, my God, hats off to authors. I have immense respect for writers. The fact that they actually sit down and have the discipline to do that day in, day out, and produce us amazing works that take us to extraordinary places, or even taking something incredibly mundane and just making us look at it in a different way. There's been some beautiful books I've recorded recently, which are in the more, I suppose, some people might write them off as chick lit, which is a terribly damning epithet and actually doesn't suit the works at all. Things like The Moments by Natalie Winter, and 4 Minutes to Save a Life by Anna Stewart. And they're fantastically touching books about life, about the reality of just being a human being. And again, visiting the ordinary, but making us see it in a totally different new light. And I would heartily recommend them. Really wonderful books.
In the 20-odd years you've been recording, do you have any favourites that stand out, or are any genre that's a particular favourite?
Well, obviously, I mean, I was so privileged to work with Ian M. Banks on his writing. I mean, he kind of took me up and launched me, really, as an audiobook reader. He just decided that he liked what I did with his writing. And I have to say, I loved his writing, and I miss him desperately. Ian has a very, very special place in my heart. But then also, I couldn't bypass the Sapkowskis, because they were Andrzej Sapkowski with his Witcher universe, which, of course, is now being recognised. I mean, it was already known by millions of people because of the games, but the Netflix series has kind of lifted it up into the public domain, and more people. I mean, my listeners, the number of people actually listening to the audiobooks of it have literally quadrupled since the first episode was shown on Netflix of the TV show. And more people are coming to the audiobooks and going, wow, this is an amazing world. This guy is incredible. And he did. He created this phenomenal world. And I was very lucky to be given the chance to voice that, and all the myriad ridiculously amazing characters, dragons and talking trees and monsters and ogres and witches and sorcerers and elves, goblins, dwarves, you name it. They were all in there, and it's a fantastic escape world that he's created. And what I love about it is that although it's fantasy, it actually works by real world rules, so that people stab you in the back, things that you plan go wrong. Magic doesn't solve everything. Do you know what I mean? Sometimes in fantasy, it's too easy to just go, I'll just wave my magic wand and that's it. It's all sorted. That doesn't happen in Sutkowski's world. It's kind of like, you know, the magic sometimes isn't good enough. And if you make a bad decision, then the consequences of that are going to come back and bite you on the bum. And I love the fact that he keeps it real in that way, even though he's created this fantasy world. And that just makes them so much more interesting.
Now, talking of fantasy, we've got to talk about Hate for Sale by Neil Gaiman, which he was tweeting about you a couple of years ago.
That's right. This came about, I just answered an ad, actually. The animator, a young Dutch animator, Anna Eisbouts, she advertised saying, I've got this poem and I can't tell you who's written it, but I would like someone to voice it. And she gave a very specific brief. So I answered the brief. I recorded the sample of the poem that she put out. And she got back and she said, I received over 300 replies to this, and yours is the only one that actually answered the brief. I was amazed. I was astonished because her brief was very specific, very specific. And then she subsequently told me that the poem had been written by Neil Gaiman. And of course, I'd previously recorded one of Neil's short stories about Doctor Who. The story is called Nothing O'Clock. Neil wrote it as part of the celebration for the anniversary of all the doctors getting together. And so I had actually written, worked on his writing before. And this poem, as you've probably heard, it's just extraordinary. And it's so bang on the money for the times we're living through, sad to say. In fact, Anna asked me to record the whole poem with a bit of direction. And then she actually animated the figure to go with what I'd done vocally, rather than the other way around, because you're normally the other way around. You put a voice to an animated figure. But in this instance, she came and watched me as I recorded, and I did it standing up. And kind of almost instinctively, I was kind of waving from my body, but literally from head to toe. People often think that, you know, voice acting is just in the head. It's not. It's in the body. You feel everything throughout the whole body. And so I was kind of, because of the nature of this character, I was kind of almost waving like seaweed caught in a current, and she just loved that, and so she kind of put that into the animation that goes with the poem.
Hate for sale, all the very best. Hate for sale, vintage stuff. Do my cries excite your interest? Lovely hate. Your life is rough.
Buy my hate. You'll come right back for more.
Peter Kinney narrating Hate for Sale by Neil Gaiman. You can see the whole video for free on YouTube. Just search for Hate for Sale by Neil Gaiman. And Peter, thanks so much for joining me today on RNIB Connect Radio.
Take care, everyone. I hope you stay well.
Thanks again to Peter Kinney. You're listening to Read On, RNIB Connect Radio's one-stop shop for book news, reviews, and author interviews. Now, before the books of Holly Watt's life. Usually, we hear from Sue Moorcroft at Christmas. Her series of novels, set in the fictional town of Middledip, is the perfect winter warmer to curl up with. But she's also the author of a string of summer romances, the latest of which, Summer on a Sunny Island, has just been simultaneously released in print, ebook, and audio. Like her winter novels, it will be available from the RNIB library. So let Sue Moorcroft whisk you away to a Mediterranean island.
Well, my characters are doing something I dearly like to do myself, and that's spend a summer in Malta. It's obviously not going to happen this summer, but I was brought up for several years in Malta. So sending characters there is always a pleasure for me anyway, and I managed to visit four times last year in the pursuit of research, obviously. So Rosa's mum, Dory, is an army kid like I was, and Zach's dad, Steve, is an army kid, and they were at school together. And it's through that connection that they end up in adjacent apartments owned by Zach's grandmother, who's Maltese. And he's a bit of a bad lad by reputation, but it's actually more that he's fought for the underdog and it's got him on the wrong side of the law initially when he was 18 and then again when he was 30. But it's created an awful lot of trouble between him and his dad, Steve. And so he's gone away to the island for the summer to help his grandmother to look after her property for her because she's not able to do it herself. She lives in the UK and his grandfather needs care. And Rosa's left a bit of a mess behind in the UK because Marcus, her ex-boyfriend, got them in a mess with online gambling and the relationship ended. Rosa's mum, Dory, as well as being an army kid, is a bit of a celeb cook. And she's spending summer on the islands, Mediterranean cooking. And she invites Rosa out there to be her personal assistant and kitchen porter. So that's why they're all out there in the first place.
And as I've come to expect with your plots, they clearly have a lot to untangle before they can even feel ready to move on.
That's exactly my starting point, really. They're both at crossroads and realise that everything they thought that was keeping them in one place actually wasn't. And they almost get overwhelmed by the choices available to them. And they find that what they want, they can't really get.
Rosa twirled her wine glass, trying to choose her words over the chatter and clatter of Gino's pavement cafe and the rumble of traffic along the seafront road. Here in the busy area of Salima, new buildings outnumbered the old, and the promenade was filled with people selling harbour cruises to tourists. Rosa preferred Taj Beach, where she was staying, about a mile along the coast, with its traditional stone villas. Salima's air was punctuated by the sound of car horns, but in Taj Beach, you could sometimes catch the mellow sound of church bells rising into the blue sky above the boats bobbling on the sparkling sea. The Maltese sun was setting in a blaze of lilac and pink. In the sea creek, a row of red and blue ferries bobbed at their moorings. Over the buzzing traffic, Rosa could see their lights coming on. Beyond them, the skyline of the capital city, Valletta, on the other side of Marsamshet Harbour, was becoming a silhouette of ramparts and domes and spires.
Leslie Harcourt narrating Summer on a Sunny Island by my guest, Sue Moorcroft. Normally, I invite you on to the show at Christmas to talk about your wonderful Middle Dip series of winter warmers where everybody's wrapped up against the cold. But you, of course, have a string of summer romances. If people visit the catalogue in the RNIB library, they can travel to France and Italy and obviously now Malta as well. Which came first, the summer books or the winter books?
Well, I have a backlist with another publisher, but they didn't follow quite the same pattern. I suppose I'm going to say the winter book because after those other books that could have taken place, you know, the season was really not that important, although there is another Malta book, The Wedding Proposal, that does take place over a summer, but that's more happenstance than an actual commercial decision. But when I was still with that publisher, I was doing a signing in a local bookshop and it was November and I just watched all the Christmas books walking out of the store because people were buying them as Christmas gifts and thought it looked a good gift with Christmas or winter in the title. So I thought, well, that's what I'll do next then. Around the same time, I made the decision to try and move to a bigger publisher, one who could get me into supermarkets, and saw my next step down the road towards that was getting a really good agent who I really gelled with. And so I did. I got Juliet Pickering at Blake Friedman, and we really do share ambitions and visions, and we can be transparent with each other, which makes working together so easy. And so I had that Christmas book ready, if you like, and that was the book that became The Christmas Promise. And the next idea I had was simply that I had a summer one. Summer idea was next. It was just happenstance because I have a friend who I'd gone out to dinner with and she said to me, let me tell you about my holiday from hell. And I said, oh, yes, do. So when I was ready to pitch my book, it so happened HarperCollins had this slot open up for somebody who would do a Christmas book and then a summer book, because somebody had been doing it and they'd gone to another publisher. And so Juliet rocked up with this book oven ready and one that was part written. When you're planning your career as an author, what you can't plan are the rolls of the dice, as I call them, when things go against you or go for you and they're completely out of your control. All you can do is write the best books. This opportunity just opened up and that's what they want from me. And so that's what I keep giving them.
And with great success. One thing I do know about you is that you write your winter book in the summer and your summer book in the winter. So I'm wondering if the next Middle Dip winter novel is going to be particularly about isolation and be even closer knit than the previous ones have been.
Well, I can tell you it's not, because it's already written. The first draft is finished. You're quite correct that I do work on the opposite season, but it's a bit of a rolling process. So the first draft of the winter book is due in at the end of March. So I got that in at the end of March, and it's called A Christmas Wish. And now I'm waiting for the edits. So I'll be editing it as the weather gets warmer and warmer. And the edits come in two or three rounds, and then there's the proofs. So that keeps coming back to me over the summer. And I'm planning another book in between. So it's actually the summer 2021 book that I've just begun planning, which is set in Italy. And I've already had the conversation with my editor. Should I be setting it in Italy or should I bring it to the UK? But she has come to the conclusion that we won't know until further along in the process exactly what the answer is to that question. But she feels I ought to write the book I was going to write anyway before we were put into lockdown. And we may have to tweak it. And that happens for all kinds of reasons, not just because of a pandemic. Brexit has been causing me headaches with my books for at least the last four books because of the uncertainty. And even The Christmas Promise, which was set completely in the UK, I had an issue where the law was changed. It was changed on revenge porn. And whereas it had been under the law of harassment and stalking, they decided to create a law specifically for the offence. So part of the book had to be rewritten to incorporate that. So it's not an unknown thing to change direction a little bit and have to tweak. You can only do it really up until the last few weeks before it goes to the typesetter, but it's not an unknown situation. I've never had it quite, obviously, as it is at the moment. I can remember my son, when he was very little, saying to his brother, and I have to hasten to add, this is not the way I taught my children to cross the road, but he was going to cross the road and he said, let's hold hands and cross our fingers, close our eyes and hope there are no cars coming. And that's a bit how I feel about my book at the moment. The book I'm planning is, I'm crossing fingers and hoping for the best with it.
I know a lot of authors are very concerned about promoting the books that they are publishing at the moment and missing out on the book launches and the readings and meeting the readers. I worry slightly less about you because how active you are on social media. You're managing to spread the word in pretty much exactly the same way as before.
That's true. The big difference is all the events being virtual. So I've done events for the Avon Book Fest with other authors and for my VLF, my virtual literary festival, and for Curl Up with Kathy, which is an event with Kathy Bramley that she puts out personally. And I'm going to be doing some Facebook Lives, one for Kim Nash, who is an author and also a publicist and has quite a big following, and for Tamworth Book Club, and for someone else who hasn't given me their name yet. They've just gone quiet, so I hope they're not poorly. And so all these events, and I shall do one on my own author page, I think, on the evening. It's the 30th of April that the book comes out in paperback, audio and ebook. And so I'm going to have to force myself to open a bottle of champagne and have a little virtual drink with people on Facebook. That is the major change to promo, I would say. The other major changes are all the bookshops are shut. Now, independent and high street chains are providing pretty sturdy alternatives of home delivery, and the distributors have opened their home delivery arms under current government guidance to facilitate it. So we can still get paperbacks. And of course, if we're lucky enough to be in supermarkets, which my books normally are, we can still get them at many supermarkets. I'm really grateful to supermarket staff, actually, not just from the book point of view, but just to keep us all going under difficult circumstances. So the paperback has been treated quite differently. The supply chain has had to change, because obviously ebooks and audio and remote lending from libraries, you can't go and borrow a print book at the moment. These other things, ebooks and audio, are all going forward as before, and podcasts like yours. And I'm doing the same with my radio interviews. I'm doing them over the telephone. So, yeah, we've adapted. But I think maybe we're lucky that with people on furlough, they're reading. It's not all they're doing, obviously, but they have more time to read. And although I'm aware that not every method of reading puts money in the author's pocket, we're hoping that enough does, that it's not going to impact too much on our income, unless our income is very much events-based, which for some writers, like Writers for Children, it can be.
Well, as you say, the audiobook downloads are not affected, and maybe you will see a bit of a spike in sales. Certainly, the narration by Leslie Harcourt of Summer on a Sunny Island is terrific.
Well, she seems very nice. I've actually spoken to her on the telephone because of the Maltese words, because she did a little sample for the audio department at HarperCollins, and they shared that with me. And I almost always say yes when they share the narrator's voice with me, but it is a courtesy, which is quite important to me, obviously, because I am a big audio book consumer myself. And so I know what I like, I suppose, is what I'm saying. And one of the Maltese words she used, she mispronounced. And so I said, oh, perhaps we could have a conversation and I could tell her how to pronounce them. And she took me up on that with alacrity, which was very good of her. And she'd already read the book in print form, and she'd made a list of words. And I hadn't realised how many Maltese words I'd used. And some of them were quite difficult to my English ear. And she told me one word, and I said, I don't know how you say that. And she said, well, you're supposed to be telling me. I said, well, I'm sorry, but I don't know how to say it. I've only ever seen it written down. So I think she was going off to see if she could find that out from somebody else.
Well, because of our relationship with HarperCollins, the book has gone straight into the RNIB library. So members of the RNIB library will be able to enjoy it simultaneously with its publication this week.
That's wonderful to know. I'm very pleased.
Sue Moorcroft, thank you so much for whisking me and the listeners away to a sunny summer island. I wish you the very best of luck with publication and look forward to speaking to you at Christmas.
Thank you very much, Red. I look forward to it too. Keep safe.
Summer on a Sunny Island will be available from the RNIB library soon. And for a full list of Sue Moorcroft's other books, Winter and Summer, that are already there, why not visit the website rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. That number again, 0303 123 9999. Now it's back to Holly Watt for the books of her life. So Holly, was there a book that you read as a child or a young woman that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
Oh, I think it'd probably be I Capture the Castle, which I just absolutely adored. And it just takes you away to this completely sort of wonderful, eccentric world. But at the same time, especially when as a young girl, the two main characters, the two young women in it, they're just on that cusp of going into adulthood, and they're kind of approaching it in such a kind of eccentrically charming way. I just absolutely love it. I love the way it's written. I love all the characters. It's a very English book in that where they are. It's got a beautiful sense of place.
I write this sitting in the kitchen sink. That is, my feet are in it. The rest of me is on the draining board, which I've padded with our dog's blanket and the tea cosy. I can't say that I'm really comfortable, and there is a depressing smell of carbolic soap, but this is the only part of the kitchen where there is any daylight left. And I have found that sitting in a place where you've never sat before can be inspiring. I wrote my very best poem while sitting on the hen house, though even that isn't a very good poem. I've decided my poetry is so bad that I mustn't write any more of it. Drips from the roof are plopping into the water butt by the back door. The view through the windows above the sink is excessively drear. Beyond the dank garden in the courtyard are the ruined walls on the edge of the moat. Beyond the moat, the boggy ploughed fields stretch to the leaden sky. I tell myself that all the rain we've had lately is good for nature, and that at any moment spring will surge on us. I try to see leaves on the trees, and the courtyard filled with sunlight. Unfortunately, the more my mind's eye sees green and gold, the more drained of all colour does the twilight seem. It is comforting to look away from the windows and towards the kitchen fire, near which my sister Rose is ironing, though she obviously can't see properly, and it will be a pity if she scorches her only nightgown. I have two, but one is minus its behind.
Candida Gubbins narrating I Capture the Castle by Dodie Smith, which is TB13308. It's also available in Braille and giant print. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
I have to say, for me, my go-to when I just have to get into bed with some chocolate is Jilly Cooper. I just absolutely love the way she writes. Her characters are so fun and wonderful and rambunctious. And actually, she writes beautifully about the English countryside as well. I think she's underestimated in that way. And on top of that, when I was a junior reporter, I don't know if I was even a reporter. I think I was just somebody who sat at the desk and answered the phones. But I had to do some research for her about, I think it was Kate Middleton, possibly, at some point in her relationship. I was working at the Sunday Times at the time, so I was doing research. And afterwards, she sent me a card saying, to the wonderful Miss Watt. And I was so delighted about the idea of Jilly Cooper even knowing my name and writing a card. But she just struck me as a really lovely woman. And I love all her books, but you probably have to go with Riders. So that's just such a perfect rainy day read.
Because he had to get up unusually early on Saturday, Jake Lovell kept waking up throughout the night, racked by terrifying dreams about being late. In the first dream, he couldn't find his breeches when the collecting ring steward called his number. In the second, he couldn't catch any of the riding school ponies to take them to the show. In the third, Africa slipped her head collar and escaped. And in the fourth, the most terrifying of all, he was back in the children's home screaming and clawing at locked iron gates while Rupert Campbell Black rode Africa off down the high street until, turning with that hateful, sneering smile, he'd shouted, "You'll never get out of that place now, Gippo. It's where you belong." Jake woke sobbing, heart bursting, drenched in sweat, paralyzed with fear. It was half a minute before he could reach out and switch on the bedside lamp. He lit a cigarette with a trembling hand. Gradually, the familiar objects in the room reasserted themselves. The Lionel Edwards prints on the walls, the tattered piles of horse and hound, the books on show jumping hopelessly overcrowding the bookshelves, the wash basin, the faded photographs of his father and mother. Hanging in the wardrobe was the check riding coat Mrs. Wilton had rather grudgingly given him for his 21st birthday. Beneath it stood the scratched, but gleaming pair of brown-topped boots he'd picked up second-hand last week. In the store below, he could hear a horse snorting and a crash as another horse kicked over its water bucket. Far too slowly, his panic subsided. Prep school and Rupert Campbell Black were things of the past. It was 1970, and he had been out of the children's home for 4 years now.
Norma West narrating Jilly Cooper's Riders, which is TB9736. And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
I've just finished The Dutch House by Anne Patchett, and I absolutely adored it. I think it's such a clever, interesting look at a certain point in time in the US and how characters can interact with each other. I love the way her books work on lots of different levels and just really enjoyed it.
first time my father brought Andrea to the Dutch house, Sandy, our housekeeper, came to my sister's room and told us to come downstairs. "Your father has a friend he wants you to meet," she said. "Is it a work friend?" Maeve asked. She was older and so had a more complex understanding of friendship. Sandy considered the question. "I'd say not. Where's your brother?" "Window seat," Maeve said. Sandy had to pull the draperies back to find me. "Why do you have to close the drapes?" "I was reading." "Privacy," I said. Though at 8, I had no notion of privacy. I liked the word, and I liked the boxed-in feel the draperies gave when they were closed. As for the visitor, it was a mystery. Our father didn't have friends, at least not the kind who came to the house late on a Saturday afternoon. I left my secret spot and went to the top of the stairs to lie down on the rug that covered the landing. I knew from experience I could see into the drawing room by looking between the newel post and the first baluster if I was on the floor. There was our father in front of the fireplace with a woman, and from what I could tell, they were studying the portraits of Mr. and Mrs. Vanubake. I got up and went back to my sister's room to make my report. "It's a woman," I said to Maeve. Sandy would have known this already. Sandy asked me if I'd brushed my teeth, by which she meant, had I brushed them that morning? No one brushed their teeth at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Sandy had to do everything herself because Jocelyn had Saturdays off. Sandy would have laid the fire and answered the door and offered drinks and, on top of all that, was now responsible for my teeth. Sandy was off Mondays. Sandy and Jocelyn were both off Sundays because my father didn't think people should be made to work on Sundays. "I did," I said, "because I probably had." "Do it again," she said, "and brush your hair."
Tom Hanks narrating The Dutch House by Anne Patchett, which is available commercially. Hollywood, thank you so much for sharing your love of reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show.
Thank you for having me. Real pleasure.
If you want to share the books of your life or ask us about anything that you've heard on Read On, the email address is radio@rnib.org.uk.
Alas, that's all we've got time for this week.
But we'll be back at the same time next week, or you can always download us as a podcast.
Just search for RNIB Audiobook Show Read On in your favourite podcast app. And if you can, rate, review, please leave us 5 stars or a nice kind word.
You can also follow us on Twitter. I'm at RedSail, which is RedSzell.
And I'm at Talking_Books.
Farewell until next week. Stay well and don't forget to read on.